Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology. I'm Dana Dennis, and today I'm happy to bring you an interview with Dr. Jivan Sharma about his new book, Crossing the Border to India, Youth, Migration, and Masculinities in Nepal. It was published in 2018 by Temple University Press as part of their series on global youth. Dr. Sharma is a senior lecturer in the fields of South Asia and international development at the University of Edinburgh. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, and welcome to today's interview on New Books in Anthropology. This is Dana Dennis, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jivan Sharma about his book, Crossing the Border to India, Youth, Migration, and Masculinities in Nepal. Jivan, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Dana.
I'm really happy to have you with us. Usually our first question on the New Books Network is an autobiographical question. So I'm wondering if you would mind telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to do research on this topic and then eventually write this book.
Right. So I'm a Nepali anthropologist currently based in Edinburgh, Scotland, where I teach South Asia and international development. So I grew up in Nepal, in Palpa district, which is where I, you know, went back to do my field work. I went to school there and came up to do my undergraduate degree in Kathmandu, and then went to do my master's degree in Bombay. And then came to Edinburgh to do my PhD. So you can see my book, which is basically based on my doctoral research with follow-up field work in the later years, is very much following on my own life sort of trajectory in that sort of sense. My interest is mainly in the field of international development, broadly defined. That includes other international responses such as humanitarianism, development aid, global health, human rights, in the context of developing world. And I bring my own expertise in Nepal to approach those wider sets of questions. I work mainly in South Asia, although I've done some work in Africa, in Malawi. But that South Asia is where I do most of my work. As I mentioned to you just now, bulk of the material for this book is based on my doctoral research, which I did in 2005. But I did continue to travel to different parts of Nepal for my field work and on a number of other issues. To do with social transformation following Nepal's conflict, but also to India, back to Mumbai, but also to other destinations such as Delhi and other smaller cities and towns in Uttarakhand, in Nainital, Simla, and other cities and towns in North India. So, yeah, I think that's very much where I come from. And if you think about the book, my PhD was also informed by my own experience of growing up in Palpa. But my own, for my studies, I went to Mumbai, so I had some sort of exposure on this issue of migration to India, but never sort of saw it as a research topic or a field that I would eventually pursue. Just before I came to do my PhD in Edinburgh, I happened to work as a consultant in Nepal for a couple of USAID-funded projects on migrant workers and their sexual health. So that took me to western part of Nepal, the far western part of Nepal, to Doti and Bajang districts. And later on, in a separate but related project, all the way to Mumbai, to really look at this question of migrants' risk to HIV. So it is very much sort of focused on that, which is what I sort of, you know, problematize much later in my book. So this book is basically, you know, sort of therefore follows on some of my professional or sort of, you know, experience following my master's degree in Nepal as well. Then, of course, there is, you know, wider set of issues to do with social change in Nepal, which is what I, you know, I remember reading a couple of articles, one by Piers Blakey, David Seddon, and John Cameron on, you know, their revisit to their original Nepal in Crisis book that came out in World Development, and also reading the revisit of Alan McFarlane back to his field site in north of Pokhara. Both of these texts spoke in a significant way about out-migration, including to India. And that really, really saved my thinking in doing this study in the first place. So I would stop here.
Thank you. So for our listeners who might not know very much about Nepal, they might not be aware just how much labor migration is a huge factor that shapes Nepal's economy and society. You've mentioned a few texts that you read that were sort of formative in your thinking about migration and, of course, your own experience moving from Palpa to Kathmandu and then on to India and on to Edinburgh. But I'm wondering, for the sake of our listeners, can you give them a brief overview of the history of labor migration in Nepal and explain briefly why it's such an important part of so many people's lives?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what is really interesting in the context of Nepal is there's a long history of labor migration in Nepal. And I've argued in my book that one ought to understand this phenomenon within the framework of culture of migration. So migration in Nepal has, you know, a long history, as far as, you know, people often talk about recruitment in British Army, and that is to do with international migration. But prior to that, there has been long-standing out-migration within Nepal across the border to India, very much driven by state policies of extraction, to do with people being forced out of their land due to taxation, forced labor, and so on, into this practice, what we now call, Lahore practice in Nepali, is this recruitment in British Army, which started more than 200 years back. So you could see that practice shaping in the Middle Hills in Nepal. Of course, focusing on specific ethnic groups as martial race, there's quite a lot of writing on that. Then you have long-standing out-migration from Nepal, both from the hills as well as Tarai. That sort of coincided with Indian independence and India's sort of urbanization moment following independence, the growth of middle classes and so on. That's where a lot of, migrants I've worked with have been to Indian cities since 1960s, 70s, to work as chowkidars, as security guard, or as domestic workers working in shops and so on. And then since about 1980s, escalated in 1990s and 2000, is this practice of contract-based migration to work in the Gulf states in Southeast Asia. So I guess what I'm saying here is that which I outline in my book is there are different waves of out-migration in Nepal, and that has historically shaped Nepal's economy, culture, and politics to a great extent. Although in the policy debates and public debate, I would say that migration has been picked up or discovered only in late 1990s with the book New Lahore by David Seddon and Jagannath Adhikari and Ganesh Gurung, which is basically a defeat-funded research turning into a small book that was published out of Nepali NGO. But that also made it into an article in Critical Asian Studies, which is where this whole debate on remittances came up and was discovered, I would argue, which is where it became such a big issue. But historically speaking, out-migration has always been a big issue in Nepal, both for those who migrate, but also for those who stay back. Writing in 1960s, you've already seen how hill agriculture was very much dependent on remittances sent by Nepali men, those who work in Indian Army. John Hitchcock has written about this. So you could see that the cash inflow into the hill economy was very much a result of this form of migration. So that's the sort of economic bit, and you can I would argue that you cannot understand Nepali society today without factoring in the social meanings, the sociocultural meanings associated with out-migration, but also the economic meanings of out-migration. So that's what I would argue as the sort of, there's a long-standing culture of migration that people, because of the particular political economy of Nepal, largely being agriculture for a long time, transitioning into in the 1970s, 80s with the new mantra of the development with access to roads and modernity and all these forces, making their ways into rural parts of Nepal with radio and expansion of telecommunication networks and so on. And migration has come to be seen as a source of access to mobility for and modernity for a large number of young men and women in Nepal.
I definitely agree that it seems foolhardy to try to understand Nepali society today without considering migration. I'm remembering a moment at some point in my field work. I did my dissertation field work in Nepal in 2014 and 2015. And at some point relatively early on, I realized that I didn't know a single person who didn't have a family member who had migrated at some point. And I was based in Kathmandu, where the history of migration is perhaps a little bit different than it is in Palpa. But yeah, I actually sat down and sort of like made a list of everyone that I sort of knew personally and their family members who were in the Gulf or in Australia or in the U.S. or in Malaysia, just all over the place. It's really, really an endemic and very important feature of Nepali society, which was why I was so excited to read your book and think more about what this culture of migration means.
Absolutely. And I think you see this sort of, constant, as you've outlined quite nicely. I think, it's impossible to find households where, you know, they don't have any, you know, someone who is outside of Nepal, but also this constant aspiration amongst the youth in Nepal, although they have not yet migrated, and not all of them are going to be able to out-migrate, the constant pressure that they are under, because all their, you know, friends, cousins, relatives, neighbors have been somewhere. It's impossible for them to kind of, you know, escape that social, cultural force surrounding them, I think. That's really, really interesting. And I wish more people sort of, you know, work on this.
Yeah, I agree. So in the introduction to your book, you outline three key concepts that you use to sort of shape your analysis. And these are livelihoods, gender, with a specific focus on masculinities, and structural violence. So do you want to just kind of briefly outline for us how those three concepts kind of inform your study?
Yeah, certainly. I thought these three concepts offered me a framework to tell the story that I tell in this book about these men who have migrated to India. First of all, to put it very simply, I use the concept of livelihoods because one of the sort of, you know, questions that one has is, you know, why do these men migrate to India? And the obvious answer is to manage their livelihoods, is to, you know, it's a lifelong practice in the village. You know, elders have done it. You know, people have been going to India. And they would say, just a way of life. You know, my question was probably not right to them in that sense, that why did I even ask that question? Isn't it obvious? Like, you know, it's like asking a question, why do you go and do agriculture in the field? So it was very much a part of their livelihoods, in the sense that this is how they manage their life. And here I don't just mean, I don't just use the word livelihoods to just talk about the economic aspect of livelihood, that migration gives them some money, but also that it is highly gendered, and there are sort of certain expectations that if you, you know, come from certain economic sort of background, I think children quite quickly learn that they ought to you know, travel outside to manage, to support their family, to experience the world. So I use livelihoods in that sort of broad, slightly in its expansive sort of a form, to not just talk about the economic contribution of migration, but also social, cultural, gendered meanings associated with migration. The second term, which is what I've already sort of touched on, is gender and masculinities. And these are men, and as we know that, you know, men are often not seen as gendered beings. And exclusively, I was working with these men, although there are women migrants to India. I have argued that, you know, as much as 90% of those who migrate to India are men. There are women, those who accompany men, but also women who migrate independently. And there is a lot of sort of debate, public debate, discourse on trafficking. I you know, that's not what this book is all about. It's very much focusing on, if these men are going to India, there ought to be a gendered angle. And I thought of, therefore, sort of approaching this practice by using the concept of masculinities, and broadening it out, not just to these men, but then asking the question, what does it mean to be a man in the Middle Hills in Nepal? And where does this particular practice fit in? What does it mean to migrate? You know, how are these men viewed? And how do they attempt to achieve what they set out to achieve in terms of their gendered journeys and gendered projects? And the third concept is structural violence. And I think it's also quite obvious that the context in which these men that I've worked with are coming from rural villages in Nepal, in this case from Palpa, but also in many other sort of contexts that I've done field work. Those who go to India come from very particular socioeconomic background. They are poor. There is, of course, a long history of out-migration. They have very little land or no land. They are likely to be Dalits, but also could be Brahmins and Magars in my sort of case. So they're already sort of disadvantaged in the source context. And I've tried to kind of situate this in the context of Nepal's history and political economy. In the first place, that's what creates certain conditions for out-migration. Then structural violence was very much a phenomenon when I was crossing the border with these men in Sonoli border, but also in other borders in the far western and midwestern part of Nepal, was that these men experienced border very differently, that this is the border crossing itself was quite an interesting experience for me to travel with them, to see their nervousness and how they attempted to cross the border with other friends or relatives and neighbors that they were traveling with, that border officials and transporters and, you know, NGOs who are guarding the border to check trafficking were constantly ill-treating them, I would say, asking them questions, dragging them sometimes physically. So that's where I argue, that's where the experience gained structural violence that made them much more vulnerable. And that's where the production of a Nepali, the transformation of a Nepali young man or a man, Nepali man, into a labor for the labor market in India is produced right at the border. That's where you get the first big shock of that transformation that turns the very political border turns you into a docile economic migrant in that sort of sense. And then in India, in Indian cities, which is where I've sort of, you know, and towns, which is where I've done most of my work, Nepali migrants work as I mentioned earlier, as domestic workers, as chowkidar, security guard, or at these sort of menial sort of jobs, at a very very little with very little amount of money that they make doing this sort of work, and this is not necessarily free labor. This is based on social networks, long-standing social networks that they have they are a part of. Sort of filling in job for someone who is returning home, or job is always organized through these social networks, and they live in slums. When I did my field work, I was living with a group of young men, young and older men, in this slum in Bombay. So life was, so they're working long hours for, not a lot of money, and they're always under constant pressure to work overtime, doing car, washing car, or, doing some other work to try and save more money. But and they were not necessarily, I would say, on the hindsight, not necessarily discriminated just for being Nepali, because there are other migrants in Indian cities, they're also equally discriminated, or even sometimes even more so than Nepalis, I would argue. I can talk about that later if we have time. But I think what is interesting is the context in which these men were working and living in Mumbai and other cities and towns was very much constraining their life, and was very much constraining their project to go to India to earn money and, send money back home, was simply made difficult and impossible by the very, very structure of work and the living condition in India. And they were basically leaving their family behind. And I got, hooked into this idea of, the production of labor is very much is taking place back in Nepal, and the production from that labor is taking place in India, and that's where these men are disadvantaged, in the sense that the surplus that they generate is being fueled to reproduce the labor. They're, you know, sending their children to school and so on. We can see this in a very positive way, but also you could view that they're actually reproducing, investing in the future labor that is going to come to India. So I thought structural violence gave me that sort of framework to tell a story of these men. So for those reasons, I just picked up these three concepts, and I attempted to write this book not just for, you know, anthropological audience or academic audience. I wanted it to be as far as possible to be accessible to a generic audience as well. And I thought these three concepts made sense.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I agree that the book reads in a very accessible kind of way. It doesn't, it's not overburdened with jargon like a lot of ethnographies sometimes are. So that's one thing that I appreciate and can recommend to our listeners. I want to go back a little bit and think about how do the kinds of career options that are available to young men from Palpa, how do those kinds of career options that are available to them tie into local concepts of masculinity? And in my mind, this is kind of related to the question of choosing India as a destination as opposed to choosing other destinations. You mentioned that the young men in your study are already pretty poor, often marginalized in a lot of ways. And so I wondered if you would speak to us about how that influences their choice of India as a destination as opposed to the Gulf countries or Australia or other places that they might go.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very important question. I think, you know, being a young man in Palpa or in a similar sort of context in the Middle Hills, the question is, you know, what sort of options, career options, do you have in front of them? If you come from a very poor background, you know, one option is obviously to work in the field, in agriculture. And that option is also quite limited, both structurally, but also, I think, in with the forces of modernity and schooling and so on, there is a big force we've been told that, you know, education is freedom and, you know, sort of you should send children to school and so on. So there is certain kind of pathologizing of farming that you could read in the eyes of young men in these villages. They don't necessarily see themselves as working in farms. So that's sort of, you know, seen as not quite desirable. So what they're really trying to do, the forces, the force that they're trying to really work with is the whole force of modernity and the schooling that is very much present, although not always accessible and not always, it doesn't always... They're not always successful in that sort of schooling project, but the schools are present throughout Nepal in rural areas, and the discourse is that you should go to school and it's going to transform you into something. So that they have to kind of really work with that force. And, you know, almost all the men I spoke to, you know, had been to school, had obviously dropped out at different stages. It's class 3 to class 7 to class 10, you know, SLC being very important, sort of iron gate for the school leaving certificate exam in Nepal, being very important for many of them. So options are very limited in the sense that, you know, very few those who have some sort of sociopolitical networks would be able to get into this schooling ladder and then into the ladder of some sort of, you know, salaried employment. And that's very much the desired for, and especially for Bahuns, the Brahmins, that's what the desired form of career options is. You know, that's what they want to do, to get into schooling with using your sociopolitical networks, get into the job as a teacher, as, you know, as some sort of, you know, salaried employed person in the government job, if you can. That's what one is really, really aspiring to. And for the Muggers that I was working with, they had, that itself was going through transformation, but they had, you know, traditionally been to this idea of being a Lahuri as the desired form of masculinity for them is to be recruited into British Army, if not, then into Indian Army, if not, into Nepali Army or police. Is sort of, you know, playing around this very much of this idea and practice around recruitment in the army. Although schooling was very much valued, but schooling was not to lead to some sort of, you know, salaried employment in the government jobs or, you know, working as teachers and so on in health force. It is very much to transition into the recruitment market. For army and police, that sort of job. And that was changing, I would argue, with the sort of, you know, broader social transformation in Nepali society with the rise of ethnic movement that was very much felt in the fieldwork areas where I'd been. The Muggers were also sort of, you know, seeing that, you know, recruitment in foreign army should not just be the destiny that we should be aspiring to. We should be also looking forward to our own space in the Nepalese state, in that sort of sense. So you could I was able to kind of see that, and there are, you know, there were some Magar families, especially those with former Gurkhas or, you know, former, you know, Lahuri families, who had some means, economic means as well as some sort of social network, were investing into their children's education. And we're encouraging them to get into paid, you know, employment within Nepal in the government and so on. You know, the options are very, for these men, the options are very little. You know, you could, you know, one option, as I mentioned, is to work in the farm. The other option is to, you know, to go into the other extreme is to find work in the government, you know, so what is called jagir. Finding some sort of salary employment. For most of them, they are left with this sort of, you know, precarious sort of life where they don't want to fall into the agriculture, but, you know, if they don't migrate, that's where they end up. So what they try to do is to try their luck in finding some sort of, you know, employment by going into little town within Nepal or to India to, you know, if you have enough money to go to the Gulf and other Southeast Asian countries. So you have, I think one has to sort of view the options these men have within that sort of political economic context. There are very, very, very little options that these men have. And with schooling, agriculture turning into an undesirable sort of occupation, you know, working as a laborer, it's seen as not quite desirable in terms of its gendered sort of consequences. You know, people would even call it, you know, sort of faltu kam, or, you know, working as a hali, or, you know, plowing the field. It's all seen as a sort of, you know, traditional career options, and the forces that they are confronting are very much directing them towards this sort of idea of modernity. is out there schooling, jobs, you know, cities, Kathmandu, Mumbai, Delhi, Butwal. You know, these are the sort of, and radio, television, schooling textbooks are all sort of, you know, telling them about these. And Stacey Pigg has written in her article about the sort of rural-urban sort of divide in schooling text. And I saw that very much featuring into the minds of my informants in Palpa as well. Of course, the desirable form of work is not available and accessible to men that I worked with. And as you commented earlier, that you know, what is interesting for me is that although these men are, you know, they end up going to India, to Mumbai, to work in these sort of chowkidars or as working in hotels and restaurants as helpers, it is still seen as a desirable work than working in farms. And that was very, very important for them to, because it was not just about work, it was also about experiencing the world outside of the village. To be in Mumbai would mean, yes, you may go and, you know, sort of wash dishes or, you know, work as domestic workers and, you know, wash women's clothes and so on. But you also experience to see these high-rise buildings and Bollywood and, you know, all those big roads and trains and so on. So going to India was not just about work. It was also about the broader sets of possibilities that it provided to young men. And some of them did, you know, find a way out from the sort of structural constraints of, you know, working only as sort of these menial, in these menial sort of work sectors. But also sometimes, you know, they just got lucky and got, you know, a nice sort of work. They may have found a kind employer, what they call owner. You know, employer is often known as, often called owners in the language of these men, if they're working as domestic workers or working in restaurants and so on. So that sort of tells you about the kind of how semi, you know, kind of feudal, semi-feudal nature of work. But it also came with, you know, certain possibilities. You may, you know, many of my informants, because there was someone working in the Bollywood, they had ended up working in the Bollywood film sector. So they would, you know, boast this sort of, you know, having seen some Bollywood actors and having worked in, you know, so-and-so's sort of house. So these are also extremely important for these men.
Yeah, that was one thing that really stood out to me in reading the book. It was just the importance of sort of networks, right, for men arriving in Mumbai or in other destinations, plugging into pre-existing networks, often of family members or friends or people from the same village, as a way of sort of finding employment and maybe getting connected to some of these more desirable positions or better bosses or other kinds of things. One of the things that I really enjoyed reading about was these sort of trial periods of going abroad or of basically running away from home that young sort of teenage boys would sometimes engage in. Certainly not always, but as a way of trying it out, trying to get those first experiences in the wider world. Can you explain a little bit more about that practice and how it sort of serves as a rite of passage in terms of leaving home for the first time?
Yeah, I think it's a very fascinating practice, which is very much on decline, was already on decline at the time of my initial field work, and was further on decline in my subsequent field work. Was, you know, I was really, really kind of intrigued when I went to the village and also in the destination of Mumbai and Nainital, Delhi, everywhere I spoke to. Most men, the older men, who had now become older in their 40s, 50s, or even 60s, had begun their migration to India, often running away, you know, and then they would just giggle, you know, they would laugh about that particular experience. And So it was very much framed as fun, as sort of, you know, this very practice of Wagner, or also, you know, running away, was very much full of giggles and full of sort of, you know, laugh and so on. So I wanted to kind of therefore sort of approach this as something beyond the sort of this sort of, you know, pressure to migrate, you know, with economic necessity and so on. So I spent a lot of time talking to others in the village, and there were village teachers who had now come back to the village. They had also, you know, run away when they were small, to the border town, Gorakhpur, or all the way to Delhi or Mumbai or to other cities in Punjab. So I was really, really interested. It seemed to me that almost everybody in the village at some point had run away, or a few of them had gone, you know, you could call it run away, or, you know, they had gone as a part of a group with a few others in the village. You know, friends got together and decided, well, let's just go to see the film. There was no film cinema in the nearby town at that time for them, although during my fieldwork there was. But so they would even run away from the village in groups to go to Butuwal to see the film, which is about, you know, 50, 60 kilometers from the village, would go to see the film for a few days. And this was quite common, in, you know, when I spoke to the people in the village, that, you know, young men running away in groups was very common. So if someone doesn't come home, then they would go and ask, well, you know, so-and-so hasn't come, and the other young men in the village would also left. And they would say, oh, yes, they ran away. So a few days, they will come back. If they don't, then you try and mobilize your social network to try and find, or someone from the village, you know, maybe a couple of people from the village would go down to Butuwal, to Tarai, or to the border, Gorakhpur, to try and find them. So what the reason for this is very interesting is this practice was very much on decline, as I mentioned earlier, was because of schooling, that, you know, this practice was seen as a problem, that, you know, children being dropped out from the school and running away was seen as a you know, as a characteristic of a delinquent sort of child. You know, the juveniles are running away from school, and therefore they need to be disciplined. But also the very discipline that goes into the schools in Nepal was also a cause of running away, because not all men had the sort of, you know, social support, or got a good sort of, you know, classroom environment, in the sense they lost interest, and they just, you know, would run away because of this pressure to perform in the school, in the exams and so on. So therefore I sort of argue that, you know, this was the first experience of going away from the village, often not with your own family members, to experience the world outside, spending night outside as a rite of passage. It's an indication of the age to come to for these men. And following that, then, you know, you've been to Butuwal or to Gorakhpur or to Delhi or Punjab, to Mumbai, seen the world. And so you're ready to embark on your out migration sort of journey, which is very much present in the village life. So that's how I argue that it is seen as a rite of passage. Of course, not for all, but for men coming from sort of background, the socioeconomic background that I talked about.
Oh, thanks for that. Yeah, it's definitely a gendered practice as well, right? Because while, of course, like, for young boys, at least, you know, in the decades prior to when you were doing your study, this might be seen as just a sort of like, oh, yeah, this is what young boys do. They run away and go see movies. And it's just sort of boyish high spirits. And of course, if girls were to do the same thing, it would be perceived very differently.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to ask another part of the book that was really interesting for me to think about was the border itself between Nepal and India, which you write about as being a sort of paradoxical border, right? In the sense that it is an open border. People don't need visas to cross the border. But at the same time, it's not necessarily easy. It's not something that people can necessarily feel free to just come and go all the time. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? Why is that border somewhat less open than we might at first expect?
Mm-hmm. I think this is quite important when viewed from the perspective of the sort of young men, you know, that I write about, that I talk about. It's an open border in policy. Yes, it is open border, but if you actually go to the border, especially with these young men, then that's what taught me. You know, I'd crossed that border as a student when I went to study in Bombay and had, you know, returned. It looked very different to me, but when I was traveling with these men, the border looked very different. And I went again and again with these men. The border looked, you know, again, very different in the sense that it was not open border for these men, because they were first of all conscious that there was going to be border, there were going to be border officials, they needed to travel in groups, they needed to appear in a particular way, so they were self-disciplining even before they went to the border. All the excitement once they left the village, coming to the bus stop, you know, going down to Tarai, you know, on the rooftop of the bus and so on, as the border approached, they were very nervous and they would, you know, try and discipline how they should appear, you know, when the rickshaw was going or when they were walking and so on. But they were constantly being stopped by transporters, rickshawwalas, the, you know, immigration officials, police on the police side. You know, there are different types of police. There are the sort of the civil police, the armed police, then the border police force in Indian side, the customs in India. There are, you know, people's transporters, shopkeepers. Everybody's trying to stop them because basically they're trying to extort some, you know, money from them. And this becomes even more critical when they're returning home with money. So for me, this is where I kind of, you know, all the debate around sort of in Nepal and India being having an open border. Yes, it is an open border, and that's what facilitates the migration of this large number of Nepali men and some women to India to work, but it's not open. It's also classed in the sense that it is it may be open to people with from certain class background, with certain ethnic background and so on, but not necessarily it is open for in practice from the perspective of these men who often go through this form of ill-treatment. And as I mentioned earlier, that's where a lot of disciplining work that goes into crossing the border. And this is where I argue that the production of labor is done right at the border. So the disciplining of a Nepali man into a potential labor, a docile labor, a worker that is needed to work in Indian houses or in shops or in, you know, neighborhoods or whatever, you know, in middle class households or in shops and, you know, service sectors in India is a consequence of the very process of border crossing. So this is where they're made to feel that you're no longer a young Nepali boy who can just run around and shout, but is now disciplined. And therefore I argue that this border is quite paradoxical in the sense it's not necessarily open for them. So they have to, you know, mobilize various strategies to navigate the border and make it open for them.
Thanks. In one place, you mention that Nepali migrant workers are treated as sort of neither foreigners nor natives when they arrive at their destinations in India. And so as a sort of follow-up to this question about borders, I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit more what you mean by that, and maybe relatedly why it's difficult for these migrant workers to access public services, for instance, when they're in India.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, this is quite a unique situation in the sense that because of Nepal-India having this open border in at least in policy, Nepalese are not perceived, or both legally and otherwise, as foreigners they're treated as if they've just come from another state in India, you know, in the sense that they're always called Nepalese, but they're also Nepalese-speaking population within India as well, in Assam and, you know, in the Northeast, of course. So they're not seen legally as foreigners. The 1950s sort of treaty just, you know, has this sort of reciprocal obligation of the host governments to treat them. But at the same time, they're not treated as citizens at par with Indian citizens, because Indian citizens have certain forms of documentation like ration card or, you know, some sort of, you know, voter ID and so on. Or now Aadhaar card, a form of, you know, a digital ID that Indian government has introduced now. Although in its spirit of 1950s, the two governments that signed the treaty would have talked about, you know, the concept of reciprocity. Of course, Nepalese don't have the voter ID in India. They don't have the same sort of, you know, and their Nepali citizenship card, Nagrikta, is not going to work as an ID card to claim certain services, to prove that you need, you deserve ration and so on. So what is interesting is that, you know, they're seen as just like Indians otherwise, except when it comes to documents. And when it comes to accessing services, you need documentation, both for Indian migrants as well as for Nepalis. And this can be an issue, and this has been an issue for Indian migrants, internal migrants as well. But Nepalis, although they are international migrants, if you think of they don't have documents, then there ought to be some sort of protection mechanism. You know, if you are international migrant, there are certain international laws that would apply to you. But for Nepalis, there are no international protection mechanisms or laws that would apply to them, or at least in practice. I've not seen a single time where it is being attempted or even talked about. So they're basically left without any form of protection mechanism that, at least in theory, is available to any other international migrants.
Yeah, it's different. It's different than, like, for instance, the case of Nepalis who are in the Gulf countries who, you know, if they get into a bad situation, of course, at least in theory, they can call on the Nepali embassy to sort of support them. That may or may not work out in practice for various reasons. But yeah, it's a different situation for these young men living in Mumbai and other cities.
Absolutely. And I see, you know, what I find quite interesting, of course, in the context of the Gulf as well, we don't see, you know, human rights wards and Amnesty and others sort of coming out in a big way when issues of ill treatment and human rights abuses are made visible and legible in journalistic writings or reporting and so on. But in India, that's even, you can't even imagine, you know, international human rights organizations or activists framing some of these, you know, some significant, you know, sort of, you know, issues. Apart from the trafficking of women, it does not even make it into of any of the international headline for these organizations, because these are, I would argue, because these are poor migrants going to India. They are not an issue, you know. They are not international. They don't attract that much of attention as migrants to the Gulf would attract. Even in that case, I would argue it's not, you know, significant sort of you know, attention is being paid by international organizations, human rights organizations. And for Nepalis in India, you know, Nepali embassy has very limited sort of presence, and it's largely managed by Nepali migrant associations in India. Any form of, you know, work that we imagine embassy or other institutions, human rights or protection, you know, based institutions would be doing for migrants or for human beings in general, it's completely absent. They're not even seen as those with certain entitlement to human rights, you know, universal human rights. And they're trapped because they think, oh, well, they're just, you know, Nepalese, and, you know, they're treated as Indians, but they're not. They're not treated as Indians.
One of the few exceptions to this sort of general situation that you're describing of, like, very few NGOs or other organizations available to help these young migrants in the last chapter of the book, you talk about public health NGOs that exist to serve this population, but they see the migrant laborers basically as like vectors for disease, and particularly focused on sexually transmitted diseases such as HIV. But of course, as you describe it, there's a disconnect between how the NGOs see these migrants and the actual realities of these men's lives. So can you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Yeah, thank you for asking this question. You know, and this particular, you know, chapter that I've written in the book, you know, was very much inspired by the work I did, as I mentioned, funded by USAID, where I was a consultant trying to, you know, do a rapid assessment of the risk behavior of migrants from the far western part of Nepal and then in Mumbai. What is interesting is, you know, migrants from the western part of Nepal are very much seen in the public health discourses. If you read writings in 1990s, it was very much about these poor men, uneducated men, they go to India, they have no sense of responsibility, they don't understand the risk, that they're not just risking their life, but they're also risking the lives of their families, communities, and the nation back in Nepal. And therefore, this whole massive sort of intervention within the sort of largely biomedical sort of framework to try and sort of, you know, treat these migrants as ignorant, trying to teach them on how to engage in sex, you know, safe sex or safe sexual practices in the destination. And my experience, so what it showed was they were not ignorant. They knew, you know, they very much knew that there are risk sort of behaviors associated with, you know, visiting brothels, or they would say, you know, having affairs with women in the bar or, you know, in the neighborhoods and so on. And it was very, very common for these men to have these sort of, you know, relationships. And, you know, that's one of the sort of, if you meet these men outside of their working hours, they would often be talking about these sort of visits to the bar or to, you know, to brothels. Or it's, so you have to kind of therefore view the whole argument of the book is, you know, if you view these practice of migration within the, you know, using framework of masculinities as these men as gendered beings, then the very practice of migration is gendered in the sense it is about sort of, you know, certain ideals or ideas of masculinities, that a project of masculinity that these men are attempting to pursue, and to treat these men, men's work, and these men, as we discussed just now, work in these sort of sectors of economy, are often in these exploitative conditions, away from their family, with very little money, living with all these men, you know, sharing rooms. These structural constraints put, you know, make them vulnerable in the first place. So the public health intervention was not looking at the social determinants, you know, to put it very simply, of risk behavior for these men, was rather focusing on these men's sexual practices, calling them ignorant, trying to teach them. You know, there's all these IEC materials, radio programs, you know, peer education programs, and so on, but not really sort of looking at the structural constraints that put them in, you know, make them vulnerable in the first place, and the sociocultural meanings associated with migration, and, you know, this exposure to consumption and having, you know, exposure to beer bar and, you know, opportunity for love affairs and so on, are a part of the package that men imagine when they are thinking about Mumbai or Delhi or elsewhere. So to disaggregate that and just treat migrant sexual health as a target of intervention is problematic. Second, these migrants have significant other health problems, although I've not written about this in details in the book. You know, they have massive, you know, health problems. And I would argue those, both occupational and otherwise sort of set of health problems, those ought to be the priority, because that's where they prioritize, rather than just viewing them as, you know, sort of carriers of the disease and therefore being the disease themselves, is problematic. And that's what I mean by the disconnect between how these NGOs, these particular projects, what they were trying to do, and how these men saw their life and their journey to India. And if you really, yes, it's an issue. It's not to say that HIV is not an issue. If you really want to kind of, you know, tackle this, you have to really get into a much more gender-sensitive approach to men's health, but also their well-being in general, their working conditions and so on. If you improve their working condition, their sexual health risk is going to decline significantly, I would argue.
Yeah, I found that to be a really convincing argument. I mean, if the NGOs are just kind of engaging in this like moral stigmatizing of certain kinds of sexual behaviors without thinking about the men's health and well-being as a whole, you know, they're living five or six people to a room sometimes, they're working extremely long hours, they're getting injuries on the job, you know, they're exhausted, they have poor nutrition. There are so many factors that go into their health. And it seems like, yeah, as you're describing, there was a problem in the ways that NGOs were conceptualizing them is like, oh, these men are doing things that they ought not to do. And it's because they're ignorant. And therefore our intervention will be like to try to educate them. It was very frustrating to read about. And I'm sure as someone who works in public health, you have often experienced these moments of frustration. Okay, so as getting toward the end of the interview here, we've taken up a lot of your time, but you did the original field work for this project over a decade ago now, and you've done lots of follow-up research and research on other projects in the intervening years. And Nepal has, of course, been through quite a lot of change in that time with the end of the Maoist war, the new constitution, the earthquake in 2015, all kinds of things have happened. And I'm curious, what are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in Palpa and maybe elsewhere in Nepal that have affected the experiences of young migrant laborers? What has changed, I guess, since you did the research for this book?
I think significant changes in the political economy of the Middle Hills in Nepal with, you know, of course, beyond the political changes, there have been, you know, the penetration of rural areas with road networks, communication networks, mobile phones. The whole aspiration for mobility is much more omnipresent than it was for the whole of the Middle Hills. So is this sort of the penetration of the capital in the consumption, the commodification of land and labor and money has, I would argue, deeply penetrated, has shaped how consumption is viewed in rural Nepal. And I think that's the biggest sort of change. And I'm actually working on my next book on the political economy of change and development in Nepal. Hopefully I'll be kind of going to be able to kind of finish that by the end of 2020. Is really to try and trace these changes, and not just about migration, but about broader sets of changes.
That was my interview with Dr. Jeevan Sharma about his book, Crossing the Border to India, Youth, Migration, and Masculinities in Nepal, from Temple University Press. I'm Dana Dennis. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again soon with another episode of New Books in Anthropology.